I thought I'd give you a little introduction and what you're doing and all that, and then I'd give the second part of the talk on the blackboard on Hydra and what the title is. I think it's Active Establishment in Hydra. So I will start with first half showing what you're doing actually in our lab. The lab is in Bayreuth in Germany. So if you know what Wacken music, you know where Bayreuth is. Now we're working, a lot of things we're doing are on cells, and if you look at such a biophysicist cell, it has a cell nucleus and it has a cell membrane, and then it has underneath the membrane it has a cytoskeleton, which is a network of biopolymers. And it's a connected network and it's responsible for the mechanical aspects of the cell. And there are three different types of biopolymers. One is actin, which I've drawn here. It's a coiled filament, so it has a helix, and meaning if it has a helix, it also has a polarity. And you have motor activity, molecular motors, which are moving on this actin filament as a function of the direction of the filament. You have a second type of biopolymer, which are microtubules, also a helicoidal structure, a directed structure, made of subunits which look similar. And this microtubule is a little bit thicker. The actin filament is about 8 nanometers in diameter, and this is about 27 nanometers in diameter. And then you have a third type of biopolymer, which are intermediate filaments. So the basic building block is a protein which has a structure which is about brick-like, and it does not have plus or minus ends. It's symmetric with respect to its ends, and there is no motor activity on the intermediate filaments, whereas there is also on the microtubules. So you have these.
So which structure is going to be the most rigid one?
Microtubules are the most rigid ones. The rigidity of these proteins is about the same. Know the value by heart, but
it's about the same.
Intermediate filaments are a little bit, they're replicated for their elasticity. They're supposed to be elastic springs. They're supposed to be more elastic than these type of filaments.
So how long are these things typically?
Well, the actin filament in the cell is a few hundred nanometers long. It's basically small portions, which are 200-300 nanometers at most. It can grow in vitro, you can make them 10 microns long. Microtubules, you can also make them, everyone knows that, much longer than a micron. And intermediate filaments, I don't really know. There are few studies in vitro. In the cell, microtubules are used for cell division, for instance, where you have a mitotic spindle, and I'm going to show a movie where they can become as long as the cell, meaning 10 microns or so. So here's an example of a growth cone of a neuron, and you see there is a strong motor activity here. The growth cone is pulling the neuron upwards. This is mostly actin, which is doing this here.
Standing still in this image.
The substrate is standing still. The nucleus doesn't move that much. The nucleus is somewhere here, the cell body. The neurite is growing.
There's a flow?
This action is kind of actively flowing, and then the growth cone is appearing, and then it's moving
up. The other things one sees going in, yeah, separately looks like this. Something directed in the neuron.
What is the
shadows of things that are just flowing continuously.
Okay, there may be some convection here.
What's the time lapse?
The time lapse, this is about a growing at a micron per minute roughly. And the growth cone here is a few microns in diameter. So that gives you an idea of the time scale.
This is a different cell?
This is a different cell. I don't know what kind of cell it is.
Oh. This is your movie?
This is our movie, yeah. This is neurites which are made from chick embryos. If you look at the actin filaments, they sometimes have a regular structure. This is a fibroblast that you can see. Some nucleus is here, it's disturbing the actin structure, but it can become very regular here, whereas normally it more looks like that, when you have these what is called stress fibers, actin stress fibers, and the cell is pulling in the direction of these stress fibers. So here is the substrate, and the cell is on the substrate, and you can see it's actually pulling and making these wrinkles in the substrate.
What is that pattern along the actin filaments in
here? This here?
Yeah.
These stress fibers are known to be organized somehow, so that the actin density is not the same anywhere.
But each fiber presumably has lots of actin.
Lots of actin, molecules, that's the idea.
So it has some secondary structure to it.
Yes. There's supposedly very often some myosin incorporated here, and that makes these fibers contract. But I haven't seen any structure so far. I think the biologists don't yet know what is in here.
This is a fluorescence image?
This is a fluorescently stained fixed cell.
What's the soft substrate?
Substrate here, this is cell culture substrate, so that's speculum over here. This is a rubber substrate made of PDMS, and PDMS can be cross-linked with a flame, and then you get you put PDMS on a glass substrate, and then you pass it over a flame, and then you get a very soft layer, a thin layer where it's polymerized. When you grow the cells on this, and they can contract. Signatures. It's face contrast. Yeah, so it's the same thing, of course.
That's all the fluorescence, right?
Yeah, it's in fluorescence. Antibody thing. Now, this is how you have to imagine the traffic inside the cell. This is a DIC image of microtubules from some commercial tape. And on the right, what you can see is the chromosome set of the plant cell. It's again, it's in commercial tape. And you have chromosome separation, and chromosome separation involves microtubules and molecular motors which are running on these microtubules. And they separate these chromosomes.
The picture of the lab, what was moving along microtubules?
It's
microtubules are some kind of point, I mean, things for transport.
Yes. So they're rails for this. The molecular motors moving along. And some of our activity is directed to cell mechanics. Now, we designed this single cell puller where you have two glass plates and you have a cell in between. The size of the cell is about 5 microns.
Right now?
Right now it's longer here. Maybe it's a few 5 microns. And what you maybe can see that this lower plate here is a little bit flexible. And this flexibility, we use this to get an idea of the force which the cell is exerting. So the idea is to get measure the behavior of the cytoskeleton. It's an active gel, it's like a polymer gel, but the difference is it's active, it's consuming energy, and it has funny mechanical properties. And we study this on single cells to avoid ensemble averages, so that way we can get really clean data. And this is one of our first measurements a long time ago, 1997, where we just make such a separate stretch experiment. We take the glass plate, we pull, and then the cell relaxes, and it actively contracts as a response to this pull. And you get elastic behavior, then viscous relaxation, and then active pulling. And that's a general feature. When you pull on these cells, mostly they pull back up as well. time saving is 40 minutes. You see, if you have the passive reaction on a very short time scale, a minute, and then you have active time scale, which is much longer.
What is actually actively cooling things? Are there molecular motors there?
Well, actually, one has no idea. It may be that molecular motors are pulling back. That's one of the things mostly the biologists say. But it may also be that it's much simpler, that it's simply a gel which is connecting and contracting. The interesting point is that all the molecular constituents of this hydrogel are pretty well known, but nobody knows what the function actually is, and nobody has defined what this hydrogel actually does. So this is an experiment where we have equipped the same experiment with a force feedback, so we can pull at constant force, and we can, for example, double the force here. The force is here 20 nanonewtons, and we double it to 40 nanonewtons. Nanonewton, to give you an idea, a molecular motor does about 1 piconewton of force, and 4 piconewtons or 8 piconewtons is about the force you get out of one ATP molecule. ATP is the energy short source for this. So 20 nanonewton on a biological scale is a lot. It corresponds to a couple of thousand motors. And actually we have forces which go up until a micronewton. So those cells are extremely strong options.
What is the displacement exactly? The displacement of that flexible wall?
Yeah, so we impose the force here, we control the force, and we look at the response of this flexible plate. And what you can see that in the beginning, you pull with this force, you give a certain rate which you impose here, and the cell is very flexible. You pull it out a lot, you pull it out by roughly 30 microns, so it becomes extremely long, and then the cell slowly pulls back against this constant force. And then you double it, and what you see that the cell has elasticity has changed a lot. You can't pull it out anymore. So the cell has a very active response to this and adapts to the function of the conditions.
How long does it take to run out of ATP?
Two.
Will it eventually stop falling back if it runs out of ATP?
Well, a cell has mitochondria which produce ATP.
Yeah.
Your body will produce about 40 kilos of ATP per day. So as long as you give the cells enough glucose, they will produce enough ATP and they will do this the longest they live.
So somehow the message here that the cells are soft at high frequency and rigid at low frequency.
Yes, I'm coming to this a little bit further. Here we've done other experiments. We have imposed a strong force, but at different rates. Here the rate is about 3 microns per second, which we allow the plates to separate, and then you pull the cell out by about 50 microns here, and then the cell pulls back. You do the experiment again. And now we increase our rate by about 10 times, and you can pull the cell out to 60 microns, and even more. 60 microns is the range of our device, and that is what limits the pulling here. So just by pulling quickly, you get a sheer thinning of these cells, but they happily survive and they pull back after a while. And now we thought a better assessment of what is going on would be if we wiggled one of these plates. So what we do, we wiggle, we give a certain extension here, which is in this case plus or minus 2 microns, and then we watch how the force develops. This is a new cell which is just between two plates, and it's biochemically activated by the adhesion. Now we wiggle and measure a certain force, and after a while, itself is pulling, the force is increasing, and you can see it's become much stiffer. Here we reduce the amplitude and the force response is much higher. So you get a cell which is stiffer. And using this, we can define some elastic modulus of the cell as a function of the force or the stress which is acting on the material. And now each point, each color here is a different individual cell. It looks horrible. You have a huge distribution of elastic moduli for the cells. And now...
I'm sorry, on the horizontal axis of the cell.
Stress.
And but before that, we saw that it's time dependent.
It's time dependent, yes.
So
now we're doing a little bit different an experiment, which is that while we're doing the experiment, we're imposing this little wiggle.
Okay, very good. And it's always fast.
And it's always
so
fast.
So your measurement is fast.
With respect.
So fast response on the background of more or less constant, but
yes.
With slowly varying stress.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually.
Is it isotropic? So you're pulling a cell in the.
In one dimension.
And then, of course, it's very difficult, I would imagine, to test.
Yeah, I don't know. I would expect
do you think
to be,
it's.
I would expect that it's not isotropic.
That it's non-isotropic, but it's just sort of stiffening in the direction that you point.
I would expect that. But I don't know. I mean, it's just the feeling of that. There is a lot to say about this wiggling and the force and the detail, but so you can see we can measure some elastic modulus as a function of stress, and you have at least two orders of magnitude of spread in your experiments. But when you scale these curves, you can see that they behave very nicely, and these all the experiments I showed earlier, they can be plotted onto the same curve by scaling. You have two scaling factors, one is the stress, the crossover stress here, and the other is the initial elastic modulus. So that's very surprising, and actually you get this curve regardless, we think, what the biochemical activation of the cell is, regardless of what you put in the plates.
But initial stress is history, like different cells.
It's it's not only history, it's just cells are different. You can't change it by history, but you can't change it as much as we see here. I mean, some cells are weak and some cells are strong. That's what we can name.
Well, I guess what I'm but so as a function of time, you know, if you come to the same cell next day and try to measure with it, is it going to turn into a different cell, or will it be like it was the day before?
It's difficult to say because, we have to throw the cells away after the experiment. The experiment can take several hours. You can stimulate the cell and get different elastic moduli in the beginning as a function of this history, that's true, but not by two orders of magnitude. And the other thing is that these two, the initial elastic modulus and the crossover stress, are not independent. They're roughly proportional to each other. So it's a one parameter scaling, which I'm showing you here, and it's supposed to be somehow the master curve of the static cell response, low frequency cell response, at small amplitudes.
So what is exactly sigma c?
Sigma c is the crossover stress here. So you go from a constant elastic modulus to an increasing elastic modulus.
But it's not a slow response. The modulus that you're measuring is a fast modulus.
Yes, but it's fast, meaning it's like the hertz or something.
Yeah, sure. But compared to the slow is
and it's not independent. It's in a plateau. When we go to low frequencies, we don't see any change until we get an active response.
Well, right.
So we're having the lowest plateau we can measure with this cell.
But the active response, so the time constant there was, 10 minutes or something like that?
10 minutes or something. So if we go to 10 minutes, we have active response. We can measure.
Okay. So how would this curve look like on a linear scale?
On linear scale, well, we still get the
you'll see some, still see some saturation, or would it just be a constant plus plus a slope?
Yeah, a constant plus a slope. Okay. Mm. Yeah, the interesting thing is now here it's stiffening. It's stiffening against the hook one. And if you integrate this, you should get some exponential. It's a differential measure, so it should stiffen exponential. But that you don't get. You can do whatever experiment you like, you can't measure the integral.
I don't quite understand. Why do you expect exponential? Because
well, this is a differential measurement, so more.
But they're very different frequencies again.
Yeah, this is at a given frequency, but it's low frequency. Now, if I just take the cell and I would say I would stretch it, then it should stiffen while I stretch.
That's very high.
Right? And the stiffening should be proportional to the extension. So as a function of force, I would get some exponential behavior.
I still have a problem because the modulus is measured at 1 hertz. And you're saying the 1 hertz is slow.
It's 0.1 hertz.
But I would say that slow is when active response kicks in.
Yeah.
Right? So slow is
slow cycling.
Right. But the horizontal axis here is virtually static stress.
Yeah.
So that's slower than active.
That's slower than?
That's slower than active, right? That is built up there on a time scale of an hour, no?
No. That means just I have a constant Young modulus. I take the cell, I wiggle it, I get a Young modulus.
Right,
and
that's the measure.
That's constant, and even if I increase the strength, I still get the same number.
Right, I'm completely confused. I thought that the experiment was, you take the cell,
yes.
You pull on it,
okay,
and then you do a little wiggling.
Yes.
Okay. So, but when I pull on it, I pull very, very slowly. Or rather, I pull and I let it equilibrate for an hour.
Well, you don't have to do that. You don't have to wait or equilibrate anything. You can also pull suddenly and let the cell respond actively. And then while it actively responds, you do this wiggling.
Oh wait, but to get it respond actively, I have to wait for an active response. So I have to wait for at least 10 minutes. So that's what I call slow.
Okay, yeah, so while...
So we can't just integrate.
During that hour, you just wiggle.
But so we can't integrate. So,
but you can still take a cell and pull a little bit more and pull more. And
but
see
what I'll see.
See if the force increases while you're pulling. But what you get is that your force is completely independent of things.
Force is independent of
this mean force,
yeah,
which you apply, or the mean stress. It's completely independent of length. So as a function of history, you get any length,
yeah,
but it's actually the force which is an important parameter.
No, I guess I don't disagree with that. I just, well, I guess there is no contradiction because you're saying you do not see exponential response. And I would say you don't expect to see exponential response because what's on the vertical axis and the horizontal axis are apples and oranges. They belong in different time scales. One is the passive fast response. Fast for me is a tenth of a hertz. And the other one is slow active response. Or, you know, if it weren't active, I would have said that so the horizontal axis has to do with plastic flow, yield, you know, what have you.
But that's force yield or stress.
Yeah.
So that I can impose, or I can wait until it actively generates. Doesn't matter.
Yes.
But it has given value, which I can prove.
Yeah, but it's not governed. It's not governed by that elastic modulus. Right. That sigma is not related to extension of a cell by the elastic modulus.
Oh, exactly.
Right. So that's what I mean. They live in different
universes. Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Okay,
fine. That's my point. That's my point, that the system is independent of length. Length is not the parameter you can use. And you only get this curve when you are at very low amplitudes, which are the maximum, about 2 microns of wiggling. If you go to higher amplitudes, then you get a completely different curve. So the idea is that you have the cytoskeleton and you start pulling, and by low amplitudes, which is about 5% of the length, you get something which maintains the structure, and then when you increase the strain in the cell, then the cell adapts to the strain, and you can't see the curve anymore. And then you get a flow-like behavior in cold stomach. My biggest strengths. So it's a very funny behavior, and the cell is very close to the flow or shear thinning condition. And that's what we want to define in the future experiments. Find this transition. One interesting thing is that these are experiments which have been done in the Weitz group and recently published. And these are in vitro Atkin gels. And in vitro Atkin gels, you can see, it's the same curve as I've shown, a differential elastic modulus as a function of the applied stress. They also get a scaling. At weak connection, they get an exponent which is 3/2 and not 1 here. And at higher connectivity, which is this here, these points, we don't talk about it, but they get the slope, which is 1. So they get the same slope.
But that is now passive, so there is no ATP and no motor.
There is no ATP, it's completely passive.
So you can't really pull the way.
Yeah, you don't get, what you don't get is this flow. Because they use static crosslinks. But in principle, you could use another crosslinker, and probably you could also make systems which would flow and which would give a static response.
So I guess what confuses me here is that, so if you just look at the time-dependent deformation, like in response to fixed force, the way you'd measure something completely different, no?
In our experiments?
No, in
here,
this experiment.
Yeah, yeah, in this plot, of course.
So even though...
The system is completely different in that sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. It doesn't, know error. Okay. Okay, let me just show a little bit more what we're doing. here observing beginning with no light, here we have such a new light. And now what we're doing, we're applying osmotic shocks to this new light, and we get this little instability. You see there's a little turning going on here. It's a little bit low, I'm sorry about that. But you get these turning-like shapes. You can watch this a little bit more in the movie. This is the new light, and we also have a hypo-osmotic shock in the medium. Cytoskeleton will deform and we will get this turning instability. And the idea, of course, is that this is like the radial instability where you have surface tension on the liquid column, and when you increase the surface tension, you will get drops. And moving from this liquid column to drops will go through a phenomenon which is like this wave building. Now, there are a lot of differences with this radial instability, and that's what we're looking at. We're analyzing the self-constructive constituents, and that's question of the perturbation we're doing. Well, it's the idea is that you have something which is like surface tension, indeed, a cytoskeletal tension, but it's not at all.
Control that it's just observed. Was it stimulated?
This was stimulated by a hypoosmotic shock. So you have hypoosmotic medium, and then the ions are flowing into the cylinder. The water is flowing into these cylinders, and that makes these cylinders bigger and increases surface tension on the actin cortex. But there is, of course, no real surface tension because they're active systems, and we can see a clear difference here. So, one ingredient is viscoelasticity, and the other is volume transport through the membrane. Okay, collaboration which we have with the group in Paris, and one thing we're working on DNA microarrays. We do this by optical synthesis. Now, as you may know, the cell proteins are produced, and while these proteins are produced, you go through the production of messenger RNA, which is transcribed from DNA. You want to know how much of this messenger RNA is expressed by the cell. Now, we can do single measurement, but we can also measure all the messenger RNA which is contained in one cell. So you take the cell and you pull out all the messenger RNA if you want to analyze it. Gives you somehow a function of state of the cell in the sense that you know all the proteins which it's trying to produce, and you even get an idea of the quantity they're producing. And the way you do this is that you use DNA microarrays. You have such an array structure, and what you put in each of these spots here is a single strand of DNA, and you put RNA, you put this RNA which you pull out of the cell in solution, and it will hybridize with its complementary sequence, the DNA on the surface. And the importance of these microarrays comes from that. You want to learn something, of course, about medical applications, and suggested that predictive chemotherapy will be successful or not with these microarrays. Normally, in the lab, you do this by applying little droplets which contain the DNA, and we use an optical technique, and the idea is the following. You have a substrate, and you add a base of DNA, you illuminate with UV and deprotect the chemical group, which is up here, and if you deprotect it, you can bind another monomer to this DNA. Now, you can do this again, and you can deprotect, for instance, here, and put another monomer on this, and this way you will construct a microarray, we have different spots of different DNA probes. Now, what we want to do is we want to polymerize these optically, as I said, and as I just showed you. And the interesting thing about this, that this measurement is claimed to be very quantitative, and that you can do this on a small scale facility. And the way we do this is that we use these microarray, micromirror displays. A projector like this one may have such a micromirror array, which is an array of micromirrors, and each mirror is a pixel. So each pixel here may be one of these mirrors, which you can switch into an on state or an off state. So the way this is done is that the array is illuminated as a function of the position of this mirror. Light is either directed in arbitrary direction or into the objective. And we've been using this and building some apparatus around this microarray, which is here. We put this onto a sample cell, which is connected to a DNA synthesizer, and with that we're trying to build these microchips. Here is the microarray, here is the optical path. This is a microscope which we use for projection purposes, and this is the DNA synthesizer. And here is a result, which is one of our arrays. And what we've been assessing here is what the fidelity of this polymerization is, and we're getting about 96% coupling efficiency or coupling fidelity from base pair to base pair, which is already better than what EpiNet does. It does about 94%. So we're getting very good results here. And this is such an array where we've done some hybridization, and you can see that if you use huge spots, you get diffusion limited hybridization on the border. Get lots of DNA in the center. You can get it. This is another example of such an array which we're producing, and you take away some GC pair here. So this DNA is one GC pair lower than that one, and you can actually see this, that the intensity decreases from here to there. So you can distinguish one GC pair, which is lacking in your intensity, at the end of the DNA, which is particularly difficult to detect. Great. Another thing is
that seems to actually be very troubling. You can distinguish them like this, but it also means that I can go five squares down and still see a nice spot on my array.
Yeah.
So all the famous specificity has gone to pot.
Yeah. So that's the way things are. DNA arrays are not that specific. And I mean, you can increase the temperature and make this more specific as we do this here, which we haven't done on this experiment. But you will always get lots of false positives. Another thing which you notice is that these chips are extremely small. It's a 5 millimeter chip. Regular chip is about an inch. So we make them smaller and we get a 3 micron line width here, which is pretty good. I mean, the epimetric chips have about 10 microns in feature size, and that's what we are about capable of doing.
Somehow to do better than the standard chip. So you can, of course, artificially create these mismatched probes.
Yeah.
But presumably you'll need many more than one, as Metrics has. So can one use this to sort of improve the specificity? sort of correlating. So I was following. So suppose you have a bunch of related probes, right? So for each oligo that you're trying to identify, you have n probes. And then if they're really as nice as you have here, one can do something quantitative correlating hybridization to these different ones. And the question is, so how many probes do you need per target?
But that's one of the questions we would like to address now. That's one of the main points. And what is the error bar you have to attribute to the expression measurement?
Could you model this? Do you know hybridization energy is enough that you could just write a computer program to model it?
Theoretically speaking, yes. But in practice, there are a lot of effects which can degrade your signal. Especially, I mean, you're on the surface, and the precise surface chemistry plays a huge role. So what you have to do is make experiments on a given surface, and from that build up your computer program, which you can certainly do. It's reproducible. It's very reproducible what you're doing. Within the 10% range, but the question is to know what it means, actually.
And is this the setup where you see mismatch binding stronger than match binding?
That's a recent experiment where we saw that mismatch binding sometimes is stronger than the perfect match binding.
Do you know when?
Especially at the ends, and it depends on the GC pairs, on the numbers of GC pairs. And especially if you have an A which is replaced by a C, for instance, then you get a strong affinity. But we haven't got enough data to do all the sort of combinations you can get.
But what's the physics or chemistry? Is it dominated by stacking interaction or something?
No idea. Because the only explanation so far was that it's due to labeling. And this was seen, some of you may know, in F-matrix chips. And the idea was that was labeling, and then this big label was better off with a mismatch. If the mismatch didn't take much space, then with a big base.
But you don't have labels?
We have labels at the end here, so the labels don't interfere with our signal.
But you always have labels at the end.
We always have labels, and all our probes here are labeled at the end.
Sometimes you probe with DNAs that have a permanent diagonal.
Yeah. The way is you do this in the protocols is you put fluorescent labels in your DNA, and you bring them into it anywhere. So you replace all or some of the genes you replace them.
It's internalized
in the sequence. And that was the argument. That was the argument why this didn't work.
Right. So the argument was that a certain mismatch sequence can accommodate better the kind of
then the comment is right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And here I mean, we don't know.
How long is the sequence usually that you're calculating?
This is here it's 20 bases, I think, for the maximum mass. It's roughly the length we're working on. Between 15 and 25.
And there is some surface treatment which makes DNA stand on stand up as a brush as opposed to...
We tried lots of surface covering protocols, and many of these protocols actually work more or less. And we found three which seem to work very well and where we have the hope that it's like a polymer brush. One is the one which is used by the matrix, which is polyethylene glycol linkers. And that gives a very clean signal, low background, very good.
Sorry, where is the peg?
It's on the surface. You get a silane, and then the peg, and then the molecule. And we found two others which were good, which you remember.
Why is it a one-way product?
What?
Why is it one-way?
Because the polyethylene glycol doesn't support high temperatures, which you use to unbind the DNA.
Can you unbind with a chemical?
You can, but it also doesn't support it. It's just that you rip apart your RNA. That's the only thing. And one thing which works very well is the dendrimer chemistry. For instance, you get this PAMAM dendrimers, which are, have a lot of active groups, and they are brush-like. And on this surface, extremely robust surface, you get a very low background, extremely low, and you can use them 10, 20 times without losing too much of the scene.
What's the link between PAMAM and the DNA?
It's directly on the PAMAM. We make actually a poly A linker. So we polymerize, we just make a poly A chain. But it doesn't need to be very long. Actually, if you put the DNA directly on it, get a little deeper scene. And, well, it's a. You always have to pay for it at the metric area, $1,000 a piece. Ours are 100 euros. Euro is about a dollar. And you can reuse them. You can actually pay for these experiments. And then what we want to do, we want to gain statistical information, as Magnasco already did in some of the metric areas. We want to take a well-known system and then look at the gene expression of it and perturb the system and see how the genetic network, the underlying genetic network response to it. Okay, so that was the introduction I wanted to give you about what we're doing besides Hydra. It's still awake, or something about, I don't know if you have any more questions. Yeah, that may be good. I still will. Yeah, well, maybe we can start.
Yeah, this is fine.
Maybe we can show this later. Switch up the projector.
This is fine. You can use both.
You must do an introduction.
Yeah, but I will develop that on the background.
You can just look like where they're the same.
Okay, I think you can see that. Right, so one thing I was interested in was a multicellular organism, and I thought about the experiments one could do with that. And one thing I found very intriguing is that when you look at embryogenesis, one configuration which always appears is that of a hollow sphere. So you have somewhere, you have the egg, and the egg, from the egg, will always arise something which is a hollow sphere. It will be more or less hollow, but it's always something like a round object with a cavity inside. And then for mammals, for instance, what you have in this hollow sphere is gastrulation, meaning some invagination forming, and then this invagination continues to form, and at the end you find yourself with a donut. And this is the gut. And this is defining the axis of your animal.
The head to tail.
Head to tail. Head is here. And tail is here.
All animals.
Yep, all mammals are these. Some animals, they do it differently, but you always get this hollow shape, a bit around the hollow shape.
Is the ball of the hollow shape usually
a
certain number of cells thick?
I don't exactly know. Very often it's a bilayer, and then you have other cells which are in the middle. I'm not enough of a biologist to tell you what exactly the different cases are. And the question, of course, is now where does the actors come from? And now when you look at the biology textbook, what they tell you is that the egg is somehow asymmetrical and the symmetry is propagated. So it's a propagation of initial asymmetry, which is like that. So for the biologists, mostly with that, the problem is solved, and you can actually take a few classic model systems and look at them, and indeed you will always find some asymmetry here, and that becomes a telling sense. But on the other hand, if you look and think about it, you find that the system is extremely robust. You can cut this in half here, and you get twins. So you can take the chick embryo, and at the stage where it has formed 400 cells, you can cut it in four, and you get four chickens of regular size, with no defects. So somehow, there is a lot of feedback and correction mechanism, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is, what if you took an egg, let it divide, and then make it symmetrical, would it still develop an axis, and how would this axis form?
So what's the main order
parameter
under which symmetry would
occur?
Is it cell density, or when you say there's an asymmetry?
An asymmetry, sometimes it's just that sperm entry, for instance, creates an asymmetry on the cytosol. And then that is propagated. Sometimes,
when you say you're going to take an egg and make it symmetrical.
Yeah, well, not the egg, you have to let it divide a little bit. But then if you just rip it apart and put together the cells, would the animal actually not develop because it doesn't know where the axis is? Probably not. It's still getting axis. Actually, what people have done, they've taken out the cells here and they've put it in another developing embryo, and then they get a perfect animal. So in that sense, you can exchange these cells, although at a very early stage they're not exactly symmetrical. You can exchange them, and it doesn't really matter. There were experiments which were done a long time ago by Spemann. And Spemann later got the Nobel Prize for finding what is called the Spemann organizer, which is a little portion of cells which actually you cannot exchange. So if you exchange them, if you take them from here and you put them in another animal, then you get cyanide cells. So it's like 10 cells which define the fate of the whole organism. It's human organism.
I'm sorry, but I guess it's not understandable. So, but I mean, why does it matter? I mean, our technique is isotropic, right? Why does it matter where this axis initially forms? See, you could spontaneous symmetry breaking, it forms in some direction, and then from this point it establishes some direction in space, and then it will develop some. But the question is, can you get this spontaneous symmetry?
That was my initial question. Because it's never talked about spontaneous symmetry breaking in the biology paper.
So the cell in which you remove the embryo, whatever you call it, in which you remove the experiment organizer, doesn't develop?
No, it doesn't develop.
And
Depends on the case.
Different in flies, right?
Different in flies, right? Yeah. Flies are a completely different system. And you know, insects are a different system. That's true. But the organizer can be reformed. one would have to look at it closely. I know it can be reformed. So somehow they develop this organizer, and this organizer then organizes everything. Okay, so when you put two organizers, you get twins, animals like that.
The organizer puts itself at the head?
Well, if the organizer organizes the invertebrates, it organizes the vertebrate column. So you get the organization from the head of the nervous system. You get quite the nervous system with all the... So the idea, I mean, the initial idea was to know the question, is there spontaneous symmetry breaking? And then I found out about this animal, which is called Hydra, and where this must exist. And Hydra, it's an animal, it's a centimeter tall. It's made of a cylinder, a hollow cylinder, and has tentacles. Let me show you a picture. So this is how it looks like. It's hydra with tentacles. It multiplies by growing these little hydras out of its body column. It feeds here through a mouth, feeds everything, puts it here, and spits it out another leg.
So when it buds, it's just some random cell that gives rise to the bud?
Good question. Nobody knows. With symmetry breaking, there's one model for that, which is like a reaction diffusion, break symmetry. But I don't know if that was correlated to experiments, I don't know. So this Hydra, what you can do with Hydra, you can dissociate it and make it a clump of single cells. Make it a clump of single cells.
So this Hydra is not an insect?
It's not an insect, it's an animal.
Yeah, find this hair. Where do I find it?
You find it in polls.
Oh.
It lives, I mean, there are different, many different species of hydra. You find it also in salt lakes. Sometimes, mostly still water, but there are also hydra that goes in running water. The one we're studying is a freshwater hydra. And what you can do with that, you can dissociate it into single cells, and you can make a clump of these single cells, and what will happen out of this is that you get a little hydra.
How many 3 days later. Cell types do you have?
There are 20 cell types in hydra. And there are about 100,000 cells, or 20 cell types.
So when you dissociate it, these cells re-differentiate? Or when they form little clumps, they form only some of the cell types from clumps?
Yeah, actually at the end, the cells appear in tentacles and in the mouth are differentiated and they die. The same is true for the foot.
They die?
They die.
What do you mean they die? They die?
No, they die by programmed suicide. They go through apoptosis, they die.
And then new things get budded out.
These cells in the body column, they are continuously regenerating. Cells are generating here, where the little hydra comes out, and then they grow to both ends. There's a continuous process. And here and there, they become differentiated, and then they die. And they will also die when they're in here. They're just expelled when they die.
So the hydra itself doesn't die, it just sheds.
It sheds its, yeah, it's a set of cells, but it continues to do this, it never grows really to an adult. It continues producing stem cells, if you like, although those are not stem cells, but something which in different cases, many other types. And they will grow out here, and they will slowly move, and then they will differentiate.
So is this sort of continuous flow, or at one point the head falls off, and then a new one grows?
You know? No, it's a continuous flow. These old cells here again, the tentacles. Fall off from later down, and the tentacles are regrown. So, what you can do, you can take these cells of the body column like this and get a new hydra. And while you do this, like what I told you earlier, they make a hollow cell ball, actually, the cell binary. And this cell bilayer will slowly evolve to a hydra.
This small hydra that we formed will get bigger?
It will get bigger, maybe a tenth of the initial size. And it will get bigger and grow. So you get this hollow ball, and the idea was to probe if a temperature gradient couldn't induce the axis from this hollow cell ball. Right? I mean, if all cells are equal, any perturbation should give you an axis. And so we did this, and the result was that about 70% of this hydra ball would actually form in the direction of the temperature gradient, and 30% would not obey, which is not a very good result and not really expected. So great disappointment looking at the literature, finding out that people have already thought about this. And this is a very old idea, this temperature gradient, and already in the 20s there are a couple of experiments and nothing works. Net of the temperature gradient is capable of imposing maxes. Then there's one publication in the 60s, and they say, yes, the temperature gradient actually dictates the axis with a probability of 70%. And then there is something in the 80s, which says the first publication in the 60s is right. This is due to this and that. I don't go into details, and the temperature gradient cannot dictate the axis. So somehow the question remained, and we tried to improve the experiment. But I just want to show you. A movie of this regenerating hydra. Here is my hydra. This is pretty nice.
How long does it take to regrow?
It takes about 3 days. It depends on the temperature, it's very temperature dependent.
Yeah, 70,
okay.
79.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, this is the hydra ball,
this is the cell ball, and hydra, as you can see, is regrowing.
You can see there is a very strong mechanic activity that actually blows up and falls back. And you can see that dead cells which are expelled when it actually falls back.
Is this constantly looping, or we're still watching?
No, we're still watching. And now you can see that the tentacles are growing and that the foot is developing. And you can see there's an axis which is maintained on the function. And
so these flickers are changes in perspective, is that
how you move? No, it's the hydra moves. The hydra moves and it moves along. And so what we did was we analyzed its motion in the beginning, made a Fourier analysis out of this, and here you have the radius of the sphere, which is as a function of time. And here you have what we call the second mode, which is the lengthwise deformation of this hyperball. And now, please look at it. In the beginning, you have very strong inflation. You saw this in the movie. And then you have smaller motions. And then the hydro starts to develop. Now look at the second mode. What actually are you having here? When the pressure, internal pressure goes down, and this mode goes up. And when you look at here, pressure goes down, and the second mode goes down. So there's reversal in time. Now this is like a balloon you blow up and becomes more spherical. Whereas this is like a balloon you blow it up and becomes oblong. So that means that for speaking about elasticity, symmetry is broken here. And symmetry is not broken here. It's mechanically isotropic until this point, and then it changes. So now we did the temperature gradient experiments and found out that, in this first region, it 100% obeys the temperature gradient. You can make it as weak as 0.25 degrees, you'll still see a signature. And then in the second part, whatever your temperature gradient is, you can't reverse the structure.
When you say it obeys the temperature gradient, you mean the axis along which it's distorted in mode 2?
In mode 2 is along, and then the hydro develops in this direction of the oblong. So in the beginning, it deforms in this oblong direction, and then it develops tentacles on one end and the foot on the other.
But if you only oppose the gradient after that point,
then
it doesn't matter. But that's not a lot of time you have in which to establish a gradient. Is it 30% of the time they were in?
Yeah, well, in the beginning, they were just right. They weren't in the right time. 30% weren't in the right time. We waited too long. And 70% were. And it's even more interesting than that. If you take a hydra and you cut out part of the hydra, if it rechains the original symmetry, then you're somewhere here. It doesn't make these huge inflations. When you cut out a very small piece, it will lose the initial symmetry, and then it will go through these huge inflation cycles. So huge inflation equals, I don't know my symmetry, and small inflation says, I know my symmetry. It's taking up of water, and we think it's osmotic. It looks as if it was osmotic, influx of water. So the idea is somehow, if the cells don't know where the symmetry is, they make a tight topology, a closed topology, a tight topology, which allows to increase the pressure inside. And when they know where the symmetry is, somehow there is a hole in there, and then the volume can flow up.
So you poke a hole in,
and that is what we think the organizer does. And that would be a long-range variable, which you can instantly change. Right? Because, I mean, not only need an asymmetry, you know this from physics, you generate asymmetry, but you have to lock it. You have to lock the asymmetric mode, and the way this is locked here is by making a function hole.
And that's what the dead cells are?
That's not what the dead cells are. Actually, these are viable cells. And now look at what is called, we talked about this, the wind cascade. what is been found in Hydra is a genetic pathway which is called WNT. WNT, or it's wingless, called in Drosophila. And in Drosophila, you know, you have these compartments, and then wingless or WNT activates something, I think it's in rails, and then this activates something else, which is hedgehog, and so, and then this activates wingless, and this gives the polarity of the segments of this Drosophila segments. And it is a short range, it's a short range interaction. Yeah. It's just across the membrane. It's self-activating. So once you turn it on, you can't turn it off. And in Hydra, the WNT equivalent has been found, and it was suspected that WNT actually defines the axis. Now, WNT, interestingly, increases a concentration of a protein named beta-catarine, and beta-catarine is involved in cell adhesion. So, and if you look at the literature, there's long been, everybody thinks that there is a link between WNT and cell adhesion. It's more complicated than that, because it involves a couple of more elements, and it involves phosphorylation. Probably the phosphorylation is the important part here.
Can you somehow visualize this WNT in cell and then see whether
WNT is
correlates with
axis? Exactly. That was the initial idea. We didn't manage to do that for practical reasons. But WNT is expressed in 5 to 10 cells. So it's a really little spot on your sphere. What you get from the dynamics of this is a hole which is a few microns, so it would be a few cells which lose their adhesion. Would be my explain this. And then you can look at it at which point WNT is expressed, and at the temperature we're working, it's expressed for 24 hours, and that's exactly. Not here, but in other experiments which we've been doing, we base ourselves on the same temperature as in other experiments. And WNT is expressed at the same time as this symmetry breaking goes on. So actually, we have a very good molecular basis, and we think we've understood what locks the axis. One of the ideas was to look at this a little bit further and look especially at phosphorylation. What actually in these cells, what makes these cells watertight is something which is called tight junction. So you have epithelial cells, and then they have a given spot where they make a watertight adhesion, which is called tight junction. And this tight junction contains many molecules. One of the molecules has been found in Hydra, called HyZO, zona occludens, meaning it makes this junction tight. And we looked at phosphorylation of HyZO. And phosphorylation of this takes place at the same time as WNT is expressed and as the symmetry is broken. So we think we seen the molecular basis of the switch that actually makes a hole in this membrane.
So this idea is that it's swelling up and then it just polarizes around the first place to break under the pressure?
Yes, well, somehow it needs to establish an asymmetry. That's, I think that's what bothers you before it makes this hole. I mean, we've shown now how it locks the axis, but we don't know how the axis is established. Okay.
But I thought the other statement was the bubble bursts every so often.
Yes.
Like the shell bursts, which means that some of these junctions get violated. There's at least one pair of cells that have lost their contact.
Yeah.
And then what these cells could activate their wind signal.
Yes.
Or do something like that. And then it permanently modify themselves.
Mm. But it doesn't.
But it doesn't occur every time it bursts. So I guess that's what, and you mentioned that there was some time in there, that there was some 24 hours.
Yeah, so this is something here.
This is 24 hours counting from when, because you've just assembled that, reconstituted your hydro ball, but so what, they've started their clock once they got balled up.
It's not a clock. I don't think it's a clock.
But the question is, is there time,
this is time at the beginning.
Number of bursts that it takes, or is it just a Poisson process that can happen after one burst or after...
It can happen after one burst, or it can happen after three bursts.
So there is no time.
But it's normally a narrow time distribution, about 24 hours at a given temperature, but these bursts, I mean, this can go much further sometimes, but the cells just don't burst, and then you get one or two bumps, and sometimes very weak, and you get four.
So I'm just trying to understand that time scale. So the time scale can be set by, so there is some probability of bursting, I'm sorry, probability of polarizing upon a burst effect.
Yeah, although...
So it will take, on average, some number of events before you polarize. And then there is some more or less fixed rate of growth, inflation there.
Yeah.
And that will basically set the time scale.
Yeah,
is there some way of changing the rate with which they...
let me come
there by
to the first
with ionic strength or something.
Yes, let me come to the first part of what you were saying. Now, the bursts are manifestation of not knowing what the symmetry is, I guess. But the opposite is not true. It's not the bursts which generate broken symmetry. Actually, the location where the burst occurs is independent. It may burst anywhere.
Well, wait, but that's your spontaneous symmetry breaking, right?
Yeah, but it's uncorrelated. You looked at where the bursts occur, and they just occur anywhere. It's unrelated to the axis which we find.
Can you
kind of
show the movie what the burst looks like? And how you determine where it occurs?
Yeah, you will see this now that you know what happens. See, it's blowing out. It's getting bigger, and then what's the first burst?
But
now it's going blowing up again.
There's a location to that burst?
There is a location to this burst. Gee, you've seen it. And something came out. So that's a way you can look at where the burst...
But that wasn't the burst that the symmetry locked in.
No, the symmetry is independent of these bursts. Here you have the burst which are here and the axis is there, but you may as well have bursts here and the axis here.
Bursts are happening in all sorts of directions, no?
No, in the beginning it's really one thing, one location here which breaks and it's like the fluid. It's just a weak mechanics spot.
Okay. time there's a burst, you can identify a weak spot that got bursted.
Yeah.
And it's always a different spot.
It may be different, it may be
the same.
It depends on the hydro you're looking at. Sometimes we found it seems to be located at the same position, sometimes it's not. It's completely random, so far we know.
And then the axis of the vertex has nothing to do with the last burst
of hydro? No, nothing. So it just has to do with the fact that the X is not Nepal, but then the axis formation mechanism is something else.
So the axis formation mechanism is not the mechanical.
It's not the mechanical. It's not. No, it's not.
And you activate the switch transfer from the outside.
Yeah, that's the experiment we need to do. We try to inhibit actually the wind pathway, and then we wanted to see that it blows up constantly until it dies, which actually happens sometimes. It just can't get past this phase of blowing up. And
but it's not secreted wind. It's membrane-bound wind, right?
It's membrane-bound, yeah. But it's knocking out wind, we haven't succeeded. We've been trying for a while, and it's very difficult. So now we thought there are other groups which have worked on phosphorylation, and maybe we can knock out some of the phosphorylations which happen. And I haven't precisely looked at that, but it seems that there is phosphorylation connected to wind which can be knocked out.
Is there a lot of cell division going on at this time as well?
No cell division. No growth. No feeding, no growth. The more you...
Not even once you see the... Where does cell division kick in again?
No, it kicks in when you feed them at the end, when they're grown up.
They need to make a mouth first.
Yeah, they need to make a mouth first. Sometimes they're so small they can't eat, and then they die.
I see. So you have to have a clump of enough cells.
Yes, so you need about 10,000, between 1,000 and 10,000 cells. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. And actually, very often when it gets too small, you can feel that this mechanic blowing up doesn't work correctly.
Take two very small ones,
but they will cute. There's a probability that they're cute, and if you put them together, they may feel it.
But so is this, now I'm very weird about it.
Yeah.
So is this mechanical inflation necessary then? Is there some way, can you do, I don't know, can you add sugar to the solution and,
Yeah, we tried this by many ways, and we didn't succeed yet in showing that. We know that sometimes hydra cannot blow up because maybe there's something dirty on the cells, or the cells just don't close. So then it systematically dies. There's no regeneration without this blowing up of the ball. We've been trying to put pipettes into hydra, making connections. We've never succeeded. Hydra always finds a way out. So if you stick a pipette in, it will move on this pipette and it will spit out the pipette and it will start to blow up again. So far it has really escaped our intelligence. The only thing we've done is we've constrained it. And if you constrain it too much so that it can't blow up, it dies. But even constraining it was difficult. We put hydra in a tube and constrained it, and what hydra does is actually it bursts, and then by bursting it moves in the tube, and moves out of the tube. So you can really feel that this is one of the oldest living species which has lots of experience with getting around the experiment, either by dying or by doing something which you haven't thought about.
So this inflation, is it to organize the cells in the fiber?
Well,
is it somehow correlated?
To organize the cells, you would say...
Well, you just start with a clump of cells,
yes,
and then they somehow have to arrange in the bilayer by inflating and rearranging.
Inflating and rearranging.
So that happens right at the beginning, or if that happens... So it could be that once the hydra knows, now I have some... Nice bilayer, I just going to second mode and just
Yes. It seems that it needs to then let the cells make tight connections and they just start sensing
the shaking.
I think it's mostly that the cells just connect and they start to pump ions, and then if this pressure builds up, then they know that they have to go through a certain genetic program. And that's my interpretation. And then they know they have to define an axis, and that's probably relatively easy on such a binary, a polar coordinate. But that's the same.
Your agency. Since organism doesn't go through a single
cell stage. It produces eggs. When the situation is really bad, it produces eggs. So Hydra can die, but the eggs survive.
I see. So when the creature gives up, even at the stage of bursting, there's an egg left.
No. It's the adult Hydra, which may produce eggs when the conditions are not right. The adult Hydra can, instead of bringing out some fresh Hydra, budding some fresh Hydra, it will form an egg. That's what.
And that egg is a single cell?
It is a single cell.
And there's some other Hydra making a sperm?
They develop sexual organs. I'm afraid I can't remember correctly. But now the question was, now how does the axis develop? And we did little experiments to do that, to work on that. And that's also interesting and really done for these patients. We looked at another gene which is named KS1. And KS1 is expressed where the head is. You can see that here. KS1. What?
It's budding twice at the same time?
Yes. We make sometimes have three buds here. Yeah. So KS1 responds to head signals, and it responds to head signals very early in development. Actually, a little bit of KS1 is always expressed. And we've been looking at the expression of KS1 on the cell wall, and you can see that there is one huge spot expressing KS1 and then the little spots. Now, if it's responding to head signals, it would mean that here it's developing a head, but here there's also a certain tendency to do this. But if you look at if you look at the number of cells and the spot size, you actually see that it scales. So there is a huge number of cells, of clumps, which are really small, about one cell, which are expressing one cell is which are expressing KS1. And then as you're looking for bigger clusters, they go down and the thing scales. Now, this can mean two things. This can mean that there is no given size in the system. And it may also mean that the system fluctuates. If you look at the literature, then you will see that the fluctuations of the genetic programs are enormous. So sometimes the genes are not expressed in the correct order. So the system has a huge fluctuation of the genetic expression. And it's our idea that the system now expresses head signals at different portions of the sphere. And then when this fluctuation is big enough, it may come to the specimen. And then it locks. That's just sure that my interpretation.
I'm reading this. So the statement is that when the number of cells is small,
it's a size distribution of this case one I showed earlier. It's actually not what I mean. See, we just have looked at the size distribution of this plot. And this size distribution scales. So the probability of finding a spot of a given size.
And what's the size of the total hydra is 100 times larger than anything plotted here?
The total hydra in the beginning is somewhere here. And you can see there is a really big spot forming. The distribution at the end is leaking out here. So that case one becomes a really big spot, which is about half of the sphere, or a third of the sphere, which is going here. And we've looked at different sizes, so one kind of distribution here. But the characteristic case one spot should be here, it's here.
And this case one expression is not inherited from the original hydra that got...
We don't think so. Actually, this is preliminary data. We're doing this again with really dissociated cells and then with a big aggregate to see the characteristic size emerging, which is much bigger than normal.
Okay. So if you just take fresh little mushed-up hydra and look at, so even before the cells before, aggregated, you look at KS1 expression, do they express it or not?
They would express it at a very low rate. Actually,
so the rate which would be inconsistent with your distribution map.
Inconsistent in which sense?
When you say they express it at a lower rate,
yes,
it could be that everybody has a little bit, or a small fraction have a lot. Right.
Yes.
So if it's the latter, so few cells express it, and I just, I make them into lumps, and I have some Poisson statistics for.
We haven't looked at that. What we know is that the total area of KS1 express is low after 10 hours or so, and then it's at wind expression. It's increasing, and it's increasing enormously. And then when wind is expressing all hydra of our distribution, then it's a maximum. Okay. So the distribution I showed you, actually I must have another distribution which is much better. The distribution I showed you is shifting. Yeah. See, this is 16 hours it's here, and then as time goes by it shifts, because the total area of KS1 is increasing. So the probability to express KS1 is increasing with time, and when wind is expressed, there is a huge characteristic spot which is appearing. So the idea is, well, it fluctuates, and then now the exponent here is minus 2.1. And minus 2.1 is one of these exponents that you find everywhere in biology.
What was
the
exponent?
Minus 2.1 you get out of this. One explanation you get, minus 2.1 would be the self-critical organization, which actually has been shown to be stable on small wave systems. And the exponent. Yeah, a robust exponent which doesn't change that much has been claimed. Figure review E publication from last year. So they claim that they get this 2.1. 2.1 has also been found for spreading of illnesses on close populations.
It seems like all expression profiles, all of these, all the other things, too.
It's true, right, that's what I'm saying. It's one of these two, right. yeah.
Actually, the only exception, which is statistically significant, I know, are stem cells as compared to their nucleus cells, which are the wider distribution, but yet, polar.
Do you have any idea where the polar comes from?
In that case.
Why is truth such a magical thing? Or is that a stupid question?
No, it's not stupid. It's just, well, I digress. We can talk later.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean,
on the lower axis, what's the line that can scroll around? On the x axis.
This is a sphere of arbitrary units and the other is a micron square. And the biggest spots on its distribution were 100 microns.
That's it.
So,
does the hydra continue to be only two cells separate?
Yes. It's held by a layer with some metered clear, it's called the membrane in between. It's made of extracellular matrix. It's a flexible entity system. Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't talk just about fluctuations because I've seen this experiment in scanning, but there is another publication which actually shows it, but the genes are expressed in different bodies. So I conclude that in the early.
Is this written up?
This is, we're in the way of writing this up, yeah. Okay, so David, you've seen what we're doing. Thank you for your attention.